Blog Talk Radio.
Unknown show. Tonight we'll talk to Marion Winnick, Tim Gager, and we'll take your calls. Yeah, thanks for listening. I hope everybody's having a good night. Just started thundering and raining real hard here in the city. Seems like a running theme these days, which I'm fine with that. I just wanted to bring you guys up to speed on what's been going on. It's been pretty busy around here. I'm putting together Cleft Jaw 2, the second issue from Cleft Jaw. It's a digital and print zine. It's looking pretty good, thanks to the work of Frankie Metro and Dustin Holland. Those guys are doing some great artwork for it, and people kept sending in some really great writing, so I'm looking forward to that. And finishing up the copy edits on Tollbooth, working with the guys from Piscataway House, and wrapping that up, and pretty soon on Tuesdays and Thursdays, I'm going to start posting every chapter a day, every Tuesday and Thursday of that novel on my website. So keep a look out for that. And the other thing I wanted to mention was Aaron Dietz. He has a really great project going on, actually 12 projects for this year. A real good friend of mine and editor with me over at Unokudo. And he just put out a book yesterday, which is really cool. It's called In Case I Die, and I recommend you guys check it out. It's a memoir, but it's an experimental fiction. It's like, you know, it's really, really cool, real quirky and short, and it's basically just weird things that have happened to Aaron, bordering on natural, you know, seeing lights in the sky. And I think he has a chapter in there where he talks to a spider. So if you've ever wanted to know what it's like to talk to a spider, check that out. It's 99 cents on Kindle. And Aaron's a good guy to keep a track of this year, because every time you turn around, he's going to have a new project popping up. And so, I don't know, sometimes you can't go wrong with just doing the punk rock thing with that, you know? So actually, we got a caller, and I'm going to take this. I recognize the number. Hold on a second. Hey, caller, are you there?
Yes. I'm here.
Oh, fuck. It's Pat Nunes. how you doing, man? I guess you changed your number. I guess you changed your phone number. I know not to answer your calls. This is a new phone, huh?
No, I've had the same phone number for about 10 years. That's nice that you know it.
Yeah. So, hey, man, it's pretty cool you're calling in, because I was just over there in your hometown the other day, like a block away, and I didn't come over and say hello. So it's nice
it's an ongoing trend with you.
Yeah, yeah. I like to call people after the fact and be like, yo, I was at your neighbor's house, and I could see you were home, but I just didn't feel like coming over and saying hello. I hope everything's going well.
Now, you didn't do it this time, but last time you're like, I'll be down in your area. I'm going to a party, but you're not invited. Just wanted to give you a heads up.
I was at a red light one time, and I saw my good friend Dick. I hadn't seen him in like probably about 5 years, and he pulled up with his girlfriend, and he goes, "Hey, what's going on? What are you doing tonight?" And I said the same thing. I said, "We're going to a party, but you're invited. See you later." And then the light turned, and we drove away. So, making friends wherever I go, man. You know.
I refuse to call you. They got to go by Richard.
Yeah.
Sorry. I keep interrupting you. I have bad manners right now.
No, you're fine. You have a it's opened, which is pretty cool, because I think everybody in the world either wants to be a rock star or record rock stars. I think it's kind of like they're it's one or the other, right? Where's your studio?
It's in Bayville, New Jersey. I think it's more people want to be
there.
A rock star. You were born there. It's actually the house. It's the house that Gary built.
Yeah, you bought the old studio where we used to all go and do rehearsals, music rehearsals. I had a few bands that I used to play and record there, and now you've taken it over and you did like extensive revamps to it, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of rebuilding of the rooms and painting and adding new gear and making it look a little more up to date.
It was
just built. What was it? 98 maybe? I don't know when it actually opened. Weren't you there from the beginning?
Yeah, it opened about 98.
Something like that. And then I don't think they just kind of painted it, and that's all it's been. So then, yeah, it kind of just fell in my lap to get it. So just actually finished painting the last room about 2 weeks ago. So now I think it's all looking pretty good on the inside.
It's pretty badass.
So is there any
your
rock
place
stars
called?
The,
what's your place called? 816 Studios, right?
816 Music Studio. Yeah, it's right off Route 9 in Bayville, New Jersey.
And I've recorded there, and you always do an awesome job. And I want to say you've actually recorded all of Bootsy Spankin's albums. Brennan Kastner there.
I did. He was a guest on your show. What, it was a couple months ago?
Yeah, and I play his music whenever I want to, like, you know, just basically cheer people up. If they're feeling sad, I just put on his music and they like start smiling and dancing around. He actually played at my wedding, which you were there. I don't know who'd you come with. I don't think you got an invitation. You just showed up.
No, I came alone.
Yeah, that's right. Ah, fuck. I was hoping you were going to marry us, man.
I would have. I didn't get asked. And really, you didn't even, all you did was come over. You had, what did you say? You came over once and had some, like, rude comment.
What?
And then,
you must have been drunk.
I talked to you the whole night.
You were drunk. Hey, listen, I want to tell you a little secret, Pat. When you get married, you have to talk to everybody. You have to, you don't have any time to really have, like, right now, this is our time, you know? This is, like, our intimate time right now that we get to spend together here. At my wedding, you know, I was really pulled in every direction, man. I really didn't have time to sit down with you, but I'll make some time. How about I'll come down to your new studio and I'll check it out, and maybe I'll record some new hits, you know?
Yeah, let's do it. I won't know what it's like, though, to have a wedding in a palace with hundreds of people like you did, so I don't know if I'm ever going to experience that kind of thing.
Oh, fuck.
That place was awesome.
Yeah, United Palace Theater is not what it's called. How is that place called? It's
Lowe's.
Boston Journal Square.
Lowe's Theater.
Lowe's Theater, yeah, the Lowe's Theater in Jersey City, which is, I told people I was getting married in Jersey City, they're like, "Har, har, har, I hope you have a bulletproof vest," which I did. I wore a bulletproof vest under my tuxedo.
So I was actually I listened to the Junetar album the other day. Skim through the Junetar.
No
album,
shit.
Say,
no shit.
Was,
yeah.
I don't know. Does anyone know, or do you keep this a secret from your listeners?
Oh, no. It's not a secret. I've let it slip a couple times. I've let it slip a couple times that I have recorded rock and roll albums, and Junetar was my proudest moment. my good friend, Steve McNabb, and Jared. I just saw Jared the other day, a bass player, at a party in Beechwood. Poor Steve. Man, Steve, really kind of, when he passed away, kind of like, you know, really deadened my spirits about playing too much music, music anymore, you know. You know, that's it was tough.
It was funny. I forgot. It's always weird when you go, you know, if you make an album and then you don't listen to it forever, and then you go back and listen to it, and there's a lot of the weird sounds and shit like that that are on there that I totally forgot us even doing, like, glass smashing. I remember, like, you wanted the sound of smashing glass. Whatever song it was. At the end of one of them, I think, right? Didn't one of them end?
Yeah, that was great, man.
And I just remember going to wherever we went, like Food Town or something like that, trying to find bottles. And you asking, I think the lady at the counter or something like that, were just like, I need to buy these. Do you think they'll sound good when I smash them all? She's just kind of looking at us like, what are you guys talking about? Well, I'm going to smash all of these. I need to buy them.
And we're going to record them. I remember, you know, it's funny, like, I always think I'm, like, a nice guy until people repeat back, like, stupid shit I say, and I'm like, man, I'm a fucking asshole. But, like,
noticeably,
the thing,
and other people have said it, too, that you've calmed down quite a bit.
Yeah.
In your
old age.
Over-the-top Larry David sort of guy that you are.
I'm simmering down my old age. Well, you're still a miserable fuck, so whatever. Hey, so, you know, that reminds me of what you were saying with, like, smashing bottles and recording them, because the other day I was reading, one of these articles about Guns N' Roses, just, like, a random, like, rock and roll, weird, crazy shit people have done, and it reminded me of something. Remember your neighbor, Paul? What was Paul's name? Paul,
Paul Blank. He lives in Seattle.
Paul Blank, yeah. Fucking great, real talented guy, Paul, and I met him right before you actually went to Seattle, drove him to Seattle in like 40 hours.
Door to door. That was insane.
Yeah, door to door, no stopping.
But no stopping. From Jersey Shore to Seattle in exactly 40 hours.
Yeah.
That's insane.
The thing that reminded me of him was, I was reading the other day, Axl Rose, of course, he like wanted to put the sound of screwing some girl in one of his songs, so he actually did that. He banged like the bass player's girlfriend behind his back, and they recorded it. And I remember that Paul wanted to do that, not bang somebody else's girlfriend, but he was going to do that in one of his songs. And I don't think he ever got to do that, but that was like, I remember one night it was very close to happening, and it was funny as hell.
He's actually building, I think he's building a recording studio, I think in downtown Seattle, maybe? He's in the middle of...
No shit.
Figuring all that out.
That's great, man. It's pretty cool you called in, too, because our little anthology is coming together pretty good. Matt, everybody's listening. Me and Pat Noon, we're putting out an anthology about how people lost their virginity. Open for a while.
I will say that you've done 100% of the work. I just had the idea.
Hey, listen,
well,
the idea is the good part, you know. If you throw an idea out there, especially for something like that, and, you know, people respond to the idea. Now, I could tell everybody, hey, just send me some writing, we'll put out an anthology, and I wouldn't have gotten the response I got if it wasn't such a cool... Everybody wanted to write about that, you know?
Yeah, I thought that, you know, I would have more time, and then, but that's when we went out to lunch or something like that, and then, and then the studio just kind of fell on my lap, and now I just don't have time for anything, so,
yeah. Well, I'm glad you called in, man, and this weekend, let's catch up in person, okay?
What, you're going to be down the shore?
Every weekend. It's the summertime. I'm going to go down there, and a friend of mine just bought a new house, and it came with a heated in-ground swimming pool, so I would kind of live there now.
My parents got
a pool and the beach and shit, you know. Oh, man.
But I'm not invited, so it doesn't really matter, you know?
Yeah. But, let's catch up this weekend. I want to come see the place.
So I guess if anyone's in bands who's listening or anything like that, Fayetteville, New Jersey, right off of Route 9, 816 Music Studio.
What's your website?
Is that a plug? Is that a bad plug? Just 816.com.
No, not a bad plug. That is not a bad plug. I can't recommend your place high enough, man. I just know you always do a great job. The thing about you is you always spend all your profit on new equipment, so you've never made a dime, but every time that somebody comes in, again, they're going to be like, holy shit, look at all this new stuff. So that
I know, but I'm living in squalor. But I got all this really nice gear for you.
Fuck yeah, that's what it's all about, you know. Because everybody's got a recording studio in their bedroom now, but you actually got all the equipment. And you do a good job. So I recommend everybody check your place out, 816 Music Studios, Fayetteville, New Jersey. Go check it out. Thanks for calling it, Pat.
Cool. Thanks. Later. I'll hold you to this weekend.
All right. All right, next on the show, we actually have Marion Winnick, which I'm really happy to talk to Marion. How you doing, Marion?
Hi, I'm good.
Yeah? What are you up to?
How are you?
Oh,
I just got back from the pool with a whole bunch of 12-year-old girls.
Oh, damn it. Where are you located then? Where is this pool?
I'm in Baltimore, Maryland.
Oh, no shit. Are you neighbors with the fabulous Jen Mikowski? She, like, lived downstairs or something?
Well, actually, I'm neighbors with the fabulous Jessica Blau. She, in fact, I just saw her at the pool. Introduced us. But, yeah, she lives around the corner from me, and we both live around the corner from our little neighborhood pool. So I was with my daughter and her little posse, and now they're all back here at the house to watch the premiere of the new season of Pretty Little Liars.
What's the deal with Pretty Little Liars? Is that the one with Christian Slater?
Nah, I don't think so. I think it's a knockoff.
That was called.
No, it's some kind of TV show about like a high school where there's a killer, and it's been going on. It's kind of like Twin Peaks, but they actually do have an answer to the mystery. I think.
Oh yeah, Twin Peaks was pretty great until I think like the last episode of the first season. For some reason,
you totally figured out that they had no idea where they were going with this.
I think like David Lynch.
Every breathing person. Right, David Lynch.
Oh my
God. Every single person in America was watching that show one week, and the next week it was like,
I'm done. We're done. We're done with this. My parents have this great story they tell about watching, being obsessed with Twin Peaks. Everybody was obsessed with Twin Peaks. And they used to drive, maybe tell me the story. It sounds like, I'm like, really? This is what you guys did on your Friday nights or whatever it was? They used to drive like a half an hour to Cinnabon because it was the only Cinnabon in the area. They would get Cinnabons and then coffee and drive home, and that's like an hour round trip, and then sit down and watch Twin Peaks on a Friday night. And I was like,
wow.
Mom and Dad, that was like, you know, you guys should have been out.
We
like,
used
you
to
know,
do that too,
partying.
But we like drove a half an hour and got like two bags of heroin and, like, come home and watch Twin Peaks.
So, I mean, and then you appreciate
it's a slightly different demographic than your parents.
Yeah.
How old are your parents?
I think my parents are, my dad just had his 56th birthday. So he just turned 56.
Oh, I am your parents. I'm 55.
My parents are cool. My dad actually just gave me 200 records. I went down to see him. I said, happy birthday, Dad. He says, all right, here, I got 200 old records for you. I hope you don't mind. I want to get rid of them. I was like, holy shit.
Cool.
Like,
cool.
Led Zeppelin 1. It's like all the good ones. So,
cool.
Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Neil Young, Pink Floyd, it just keeps going, you know?
Oh, my God. I think I at one point had all those records.
And I have them now. These are probably the ones you put out to your trash.
How old are you?
Oh, he does? I am 30, I'm going to be 32 in November. I was born on Thanksgiving.
Wow.
Thanksgiving Day,
cool. Even my older kids, I have kids that are 25, 23, and 12.
Oh, cool. So I got in the game
late and stayed in too long.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know what I'm doing. I just got married.
Happy wedding.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Oh, it was great. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Some of my wedding guests were kind of like, you know, like Pat, the caller who was just there. He was a little grumpy. He got a little too drunk, but you know, what are you gonna do? So it's really cool you called in. I'm glad to have you on the show because I've been checking out checking out your books, and you have some really, really great, great stuff. They're all in my Amazon cart, waiting to summer reading, and really interested to talk about. Could you please just describe to people who don't know what Glenrock Book of the Dead is about?
Sure. The Glenrock Book of the Dead is a little teeny skinny book that contains 51 portraits of people that I knew or basically passed through my life who died. And they are named not with the names of the people, but with like things like the jeweler, the real estate agent, the bad influence, stuff like that. And they're identified by their death date. And then they're like miniature essays. Most of them are 300 words or less. And they are in the book. They're in order. They're in autobiographical order, so to speak. So, like the very first one in the book is the first person that I ever heard of that died, and then it kind of goes through up to 2007, which is the year that I was writing the book, and has, you know, at that point I had sons that were teenagers that unfortunately had friends that you know died at high school graduation or in Iraq or whatever. You know, thing like that. Do you want to hear one of them?
I would love to. Read as many as you'd like.
I'll read you, let's see. This is one, right? This is one of the early ones in the book. The neighbor died in 1978. He appeared at our bus stop one day in sixth grade with his blonde crew cut and goofy smile. His father had become principal of the high school, and they'd bought the mysterious house two doors down from us in the development. While all the other houses had flat green lawns or perhaps a single weeping cherry, this house had so many trees you could hardly see the front door. The only member of the family we really knew was the dog, a huge woolly brown Airedale named Chumley, who caused great hilarity and panic whenever he managed to bound away from the person holding his chain. The boy, on the other hand, stayed on the leash, which was short, since his father was the principal. No, he could not come out to play spud, or ride bikes, or take bong hits, if we ever asked, which I'm not sure we did. These days, if you want to know a secret, you just turn on the television. Back then, there were only three channels, and none of them had shows where people who were not professional actors wept and threw chairs at one another. Secrets were simply more secret, which meant rumors were more baroque. For example, people said the reason our music teacher was a little strange was because he had run over his own child playing in leaves in the driveway. It was hard to stop worrying about this. There were huge piles of leaves in those days, particularly in front of our neighbor's house with all those trees. My neighbor killed himself in his first year of college. My mother saw it in the paper, and no one else has mentioned it since, or come up with any further details. How can this be that we have no idea what happened to this boy, that no one remembers a single conversation with him? Today I found his father's phone number on the internet, which took about 10 seconds, and I called it. I told him that I was thinking about his son. Because our old class is having a reunion, I said, fumbling for an excuse. I heard he died. There was a long pause. He said, yes, he did. Have fun at your reunion. So that's one of them.
I was really drawn to this book because I was just kind of writing about one death I had known. I mean everybody's had that. I was just actually just talking about that with the first caller, my drummer who died, and just remember,
I heard him saying something.
Yeah. So I saw your book. And I was like, oh, wow, a whole book of...
Right, so the people in the book range very much from, like, say, this guy that, honestly, I barely knew him, and I hadn't thought much about him until I decided to write the book. But, you know, other people in the book are, like, my father, my first husband, I had a baby that died. You know, so there's, like, an incredible range of intimacy. Like, often people hear, you know, oh, my God, you wrote a book of 51 people that you know that died. It's like must have lived through a war or something. And in a way, I did.
Yeah.
With AIDS and with the amount of friends that I had were hard partiers and stuff. The 80s and 90s were a little rough on my
Yeah.
My demographic.
Damn straight.
But yeah, but and you know, continues to this day with some stuff. But yeah, I don't know. It just came to me to do this, and I think this the book is. It's not as sad as you would think. I mean, that's
no,
really
I don't.
Tough.
I've read samples of it. I wouldn't say it's by any means a sad book. Some people are just like really drawn away from, you know, the idea of writing about people dying, but hey man, it's life, you know. You know,
right.
a book about that is it intrigued me.
Well,
say that
you
much.
Know, my most like kind of my most famous book is called First Comes Love, and it's the story of my first marriage. I went to Mardi Gras in 1983. And
yeah.
The reason I went is because I was living in New York and I was like, really, I was about 22 and I was going completely mental. And my friends,
sure.
You know, thought we've got to get her out of here. So their big idea
yeah.
of like an excellent rest cure for me was to go to Mardi Gras. So they
yeah.
dragged me down to Mardi Gras and I fell in love with the bartender in a gay bar, a gay person.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I fell like crazy in love. Like no one could possibly explain to me that this guy was gay. I mean, I already knew he was gay. I just
yeah.
could care less. And I was
yeah.
completely obsessed. And I guess somehow magically it, you know, he fell in love with me too. So I ended
yeah.
up marrying this guy, moving down there. Then we moved to Austin. And then, by this time, you know, we were IV drug abusers, and he was gay. So as you can imagine, we had plenty of exposure to when we read about AIDS, we were like, oh, my God, we
yeah.
have to get this test. And this is now pretty early on, but when they had first invented it or discovered it and didn't even,
sure.
you had no idea how bad it was going to be or anything. And so we get tested, and I was negative, and he was positive. And I still didn't think that was the worst thing in the world, and I thought, you know, we should just go ahead and get married and have kids. So we did. And when our sons were 4 and 6, he died of AIDS. And then First Comes Love is the story of this whole thing. And it's, now it seems like almost a period piece because it's so much of the 80s and early 90s and the things that happened to it seem like a million years ago now. But and the boys, my sons are 25 and 23.
Yeah.
So I guess in a way, the transition to my current book would be The Highs and the Low 50s is like the first book I've ever written that doesn't have so much heavy stuff in it. Like go ahead.
Would you say, do you think this book is going to wind up being a period piece 20 years from now? Or is it today's
yeah,
version
the highs
of your,
and low 50s? That's funny.
Yeah.
That's a good question. Well, you know, I think I'm in my generation, like these baby boomers
mm-hmm.
who are all ending up like single and running around in their 50s and 60s and trying to figure out like how's this going to work. I mean, I'm
yeah.
sure it will be some sort of phenomenon that's viewed in the future as, oh, that was interesting. You know,
yeah.
right now it doesn't feel like that, but it's not, especially women. There's so many single women in my age group, I think, you know, far more than there ever have been. And the old patterns of what to do about it really aren't working for us. So,
yeah, right. There's old single women. Is there enough old single men around, or is it not?
Well, not
thing?
Really. I mean, for one thing, I guess there's, first of all, there's more women than men in general. And men who are, you know, the good ones, they don't.
Yeah.
The wife tends to keep them. Or whatever. But then it's not just that. It's that men also. It turns out that they do not like being like. Even though when men are young, the idea is that the men are the commitment phobes and the wives are trying to hook them. Well, in
yeah.
the older ages, it's the opposite. The men really want to get married again because they loved it when they had dinner getting cooked in the house and the blah, blah, blah. And like they didn't have to do anything except, you know, have this wife to basically run everything. So when they
yeah.
end up single in later, they're like, oh, they're very motivated to get married again. But the women are totally unmotivated to get married again because they're like, shit, I'm not doing all that. I'm not doing that again.
And they really have nothing to gain from it. They have nothing to gain
from
it either.
Women by age,
rarely want to remarry, but the men my age really want to remarry. So it's a hilarious reversal of the, you know, what supposedly is believed about younger people. So the men don't stay on the market too long, because if they could find somebody to, you know, get married to, they go ahead and marry them, you know, and get that dentist appointment made. So.
I wish, I'm just like thinking in my head, I really wish that, you know, your dad, maybe if your dad had passed away, if he's still alive, I think you said your dad just unfortunately died, but it would be so great in my mind if your dad was 93 years old or whatever, and on the couch, and the doorbell rings, and he answers it, and there's like, you know, I don't know, a 55-year-old guy who wants to take you out on a date, and he's like giving him the evil eye, you know, it's like, what's your name?
That's just my daughter. No, I'm afraid my reputation is yeah, I think those days are over, bud. If they ever even happened. I mean, first of all, I was a teenager in, you know, the 70s, and it was, you know, not really. There wasn't a lot of dads yelling at your boyfriend back then. I don't know. It just was more, you know, the parents
know.
Were these pot parties. They couldn't be bothered.
Yeah. Yeah, they were having fun. They didn't give a fuck. They didn't want to yell at a teenage boy, please take our daughter out of the house. We want to have fun, you know.
Right. Get her out of here. Don't eat our pot brownies. Those are ours.
Oh, the best. So now let me ask you about a little more about your book. You say it's not heavy material. How would you describe Highs in the mid 50s?
Low 50s, baby. Low 50s. So it starts in February of 2009 when I got divorced from my second husband. So I was widowed, then I was remarried, then I was divorced after 10 years.
Yes.
And I had been living in the middle of nowhere in the countryside in Pennsylvania. And I lived in this giant house because we had my blended family. I had 5 kids, you know, 8 million pets. It was like a freaking sitcom over there. And then all of a sudden, basically within a very short time, the whole thing went to hell. Like, all the older kids went to college. My husband, you know, we flew up and moved out. And it's like me and my daughter in this house that's the size of an airplane hangar in the middle of nowhere. And I pulled myself together and realized I had to get out of there. So I already was working in Baltimore, which is, say, 45 minutes from this place. And I moved down to Baltimore with my little daughter, who was then in third grade. And my husband was already seeing someone. It wasn't like 2 seconds. We'd already been apart like a year. And so he was seeing someone. It seemed pretty serious. And that when that happens, that's when you get like, okay, I'm moving on, you know. It just makes you realize you better get your ass in gear and move on, too. So I was trying to get my ass in gear and move on, too. But, you know. So my enthusiasm for the project caused me to launch into many very unadvisable situations. And like the first thing that happens is there's like these construction workers working in the basement, and one of them is like this really hot, like 33-year-old guy from Central America or something who not only does not speak English, but is probably illiterate in his own language. And he's just giving me like the 100% like ogle, you know, look every time he comes in and out of the basement. And I'm a little wounded. I'm a little, and so like I'm really responding to this ogling. Like I'm loving it. You know, I love that the 33-year-old hot construction worker who does not speak English and is like ogling. So one of the first chapters, it's called Desperate Housewives of Roland Park, which is my neighborhood. And it tells about what happened when I attempted to form a relationship with this girl. Which I cannot tell you. I mean, it involved a lot of use of Google Translate. And also, not just that. I mean, early on, I had showed him, he had noticed that, somehow we had discussed that I was a writer. And he had, like, looked at this big shelf of all my books in my house. And he pointed to one of the books, and I told him, you know, oh, that's a book about my first marriage. My husband died of AIDS. So, you know, that sunk in. That sunk into him. So he already figured, you know, he already was, like, terrified of me, okay?
Yeah, you said the magic word in this relationship, yeah.
Right. So I hate to give away the whole thing, but I might as well, because it's hilarious, and it shows you that what kind of stuff is in this book, and that I'm not hesitating to tell anything. So, all this goes on and on, and then finally we, like, make a date, to see each other. I mean, Maze goes on and on. It's like he's like sneaking out of the basement during work and we're like, you know, hugging. But then he starts like kind of like feeling me up, but he has this like icky way of doing it that he's like squeezing me like kind of like he's trying to juice an orange or something. I'm not liking it that. Yeah, he doesn't have the right technique. I'm thinking, how can this really cute guy, no one's ever like explained to him that this is not the way to do it. But, you know,
women,
I'm not giving up
South
on
America
him.
Women in South America are built different, I guess, you know.
That's what I thought. I thought, what about these chicas in El Salvador? So finally, you know, the squeezing and the hugging and the looking, you know, we make a plan that I'm going to pick him up in his barrio on a Saturday and have a date with him. And, you know, we're both so nervous because it's like, first of all, obviously not allowed, A, you know, to probably get fired. And just the whole thing is so inappropriate. It's like inappropriate beyond belief. And it's not like I don't know this. But I basically feel like if I don't have sex, I am not getting on with my life. I have to have sex.
Yeah.
This is my chance to have sex. I must do this, you know. So I feel that I've been designated to go pick up this guy in the barrio, bring him to my house, and have sex with him. So I'm doing it, okay? So I go down there, and I get him, you know, and come back to my house. We're so nervous. It's so awkward. You know, finally we, like, parade up to my bedroom, and it's still so awkward. And then I, like, throw my shirt off, and I'm, like, sitting there in my bra. And then he starts telling me, oh no. And in Spanish he tells me that he forgot his condoms. And I'm like, what? You know, it seems unbelievable. Like, this whole thing is set up so that I can have sex, so I can move on to my marriage.
Yeah.
And he came all the way from, you know, the barrio without his condom.
Yeah.
For this reason,
yeah.
I had to look up condom in Google Translate and, like, verify through 3,000 different translations of the word condom that he really had forgotten his condoms. Okay, so in the midst of all this, he bursts into tears. He's crying his eyes out in my bedroom, in my bed, with me sitting there in the bra. At this point, I'm, like, really wanting to put my shirt back on. What the hell? And he says, oh, it's so sad, so sad. And I'm like, why are you crying? What's the matter? You know, what's the matter? And then he says, oh, it's my brother. My brother. He's trying to come to the United States, but the coyote wants $3,000. Basically, the whole thing was a setup, and he wanted me to give him $3,000 to get his brother. So now I'm, like, crying, too, you know, it's so sad.
Yeah.
So I'm, like, quickly whip my shirt back on, and I'm like, dude, you cannot do this. You cannot, like, get a woman in her bedroom and ask her for $3,000.
Yeah.
Like a freaking nightmare. So we go out on the porch. I'm with the Google Translator, and I'm trying to tell him, like, I know you didn't mean to hurt my feelings, but you really, really hurt my feelings. And then I take him back to the barrio. I give him $20. And, like, later I find out that he's, like, done this with 7 other clients and has, like, 18 children in Atlanta.
Oh, my God. Well, it's a good thing you got the hell away from this guy.
Oh, God, I miss him so.
Yeah, his Christmas stocking is still hanging on the mantle. He never took it down, right?
Exactly. But I mean, the fact, I guess this is the reason I'm telling you this story is, will give you the idea that I really don't try to, you know, hide the terrible details of these stupid situations.
Oh, I had no doubt. Oh,
well,
sure.
I just hope nothing like this ever happens to you or anyone.
I can tell you some fucked up stories, but you know, I don't.
You're a newly
know.
Married man.
Yeah, exactly. I'll let the years drift away before I start telling my horrible stories. So, listen, I promise
you
one day I'll tell
you
the nose
story. Yes,
yeah, I do write.
Tell me about your writing.
Well, I got a book of short stories that came out last year called Or Something Like That. And it's just, it was like some stuff that, you know, published here and there online. And I kind of wrangled it all together in a new collection. And then I've been writing novels for a while, you know, and literary fiction, kind of funny shit. And I just really got into finally, like, submitting shit out. And one book's coming out in about a month from a press that... I dig a lot from Jersey, called Toll Booth.
Mm-hmm.
So,
wait, where did you grow up?
I grew up near Asbury Park. I grew up in Bayville, Tom's River. I used to hang out a lot in Tom's River. Where are you
from? Yeah, wow.
I knew you were from Esper.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. So,
what town are you from?
I'm from actually from Ocean Township. You know it?
Yeah.
You know, okay. So I grew up in Ocean Township, and I went to OTHS. My father went to Asbury High. I mean, I'm very much from that area. Yeah, my father was a quarterback at Asbury High.
Really?
So, yeah, my family's from that area for generations, but now only, like, my cousin, you know, I have an aunt that lives there and stuff. I'm going to do a book signing for this book in Asbury Park, though, which I'm very excited about.
Where and when?
July 28th.
Uh-huh.
At this place called Words! Exclamation point.
Oh, I know where that is.
Words! You do?
Words! I'll be there.
You got to come.
Yeah, I'm going to bring the crazy kids from Medium to New Jersey Zine. They're fucking nuts. You'll love these guys.
You'll
fall in love with them.
I will. So the place, so have you been in Words? I heard it was very little.
Been in Words? Yeah, it's a small bookshop, but, you know, they're the best. They're the best places, these little bookshops. Can't beat them.
I agree.
Used to have one right around
the corner
for me. It's closed.
And you live in Washington Heights?
Yeah, I'm in Washington Heights. Yes, I am.
My sister lived there for a while back in the 80s. So I know it a little bit. Those were our bad old days, though. I remember is...
Yeah, when you say Washington Heights in the 80s, I know exactly what you're up to, and it's awesome.
Yeah.
So, party on, Marion, you know.
Okay.
So,
do you have another guest that you're going to talk to now?
Yeah. Do you know Tim Geiger? I don't know if you know him.
I do. I have him.
He's going to come on. He's going to come on in a minute, and then hopefully he's going to make us laugh and stuff, because... I worked all day and I'm getting fucking tired.
I hope I didn't contribute to it. All right. Well, I hope
I see you
in Asbury Park on July 28th. And can I say that if anyone wants to come see me, they could look on my website at marionwinnick.com and they could see where my events are and they could order the book and they could watch my funny book trailer and all that stuff.
Should
I spell my name? MarionWinnick.com.
Marion, I hope you have a great time in the pool. Good luck down in Baltimore, and say hi to Jessica for me, okay?
I will. And Jen, too. Take care, bud.
Yeah. All right. Talk soon, Marion.
Party on.
Thanks again.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. So, next on the show, we're going to talk to Tim Geiger. Tim, how do you say your name? Geiger? Geiger? I don't know.
Hey, bud. You can say it Geiger.
Geiger, that's a badass name. Geiger, you sound like an action star. You sound like somebody from the future with some kind of like laser machine gun shit.
Well, I'm going to change my name to Timothy Danger.
Danger, yeah.
Timothy Danger
call me
is a much
Danger.
Better name.
You don't walk
right,
into rooms. You just roll into rooms like how they do when they roll in and pop up with a gun. Tim Danger. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, actually... I slide in under the electric slide, motherfucker. Let's do that slide right in. I'm in there.
Sweet, man. So
that
you
was a great guest.
Oh, she's awesome.
Your last guest was great. Yeah, I thought it was fantastic. Yeah, I'm calling from Dedham, Massachusetts.
Oh, cool.
I'm in the only place
like...
in the house. Yeah, I'm in the only place in the house I get phone reception, which is like I'm lying in my bedroom. I got my shirt off, so it's really
great.
Good when I
Perfect.
Got like I get my reception here because like you know when I want to get sexy I'm already in my bed.
Oh, so you're like feeling sexy right now? That's sweet, it's awesome.
I am.
I'm
for the radio show. It's good.
Huh? Yeah. Sometimes
yeah,
on
radio
these shows. Oh no, what's that? Hold on a second.
Oh, we're
getting a phone call. I like a regular phone call, not a radio phone call. Let me see who the hell this is. It's my friend Mark. The guy publishing my novel, he's calling me to talk about the book, but he's just going to have to wait, man. This fucking guy.
Anyway. I can shout him down. If you want to put him on now, I'll whip him down.
It wouldn't work, because the radio show, you have to, like, call in on a separate line, and he's calling in on my regular cell phone, and it's all good. So So you're kind of close to Boston, or what's your proximity to that?
Yeah, it's about a 10-minute drive into Boston. You know, buzz in and out. I'm 10 minutes from everywhere. You know, that's the thing with Boston. People are like, oh, you're 10 minutes away. So I'm 10 minutes away from everywhere.
Yeah, I bet you are, man. That's a good attitude to have. You know, I would say that. I'd say the same thing. I'm 10 minutes from everywhere. So So I want to talk about kind of projects you got going on these days. What do you have anything you're promoting? Or this is how well I prep for the shows. I don't read anything about them, so I just ask them what the fuck's going on. What do you have going on these days, man?
Well, currently I'm promoting. I got a new chapbook of poetry. That's the main promotion. That's the biggest thing to buy. It's called Antisocial Network, and it's put out by Rusty Barnes' Redneck Press.
That's got an amazing cover. I love the cover of that book. It's so badass.
Yeah, the cover is $9, and the poems are free.
Yeah.
So you get the whole package for $9.
Yeah. For everybody listening, the cover for this, well, just look this thing up and buy it. But you know, I'll describe the cover to you. It's like a mock Facebook page, and you have like I think celebrities kind of like slightly bashing you on it as if they were your friends. It's funny shit.
Yeah, they're my antisocial friends. I mean, my friends on the antisocial network are Ted D and Norman Mailer, Casey Anthony, and John Wayne Gacy and Plath. They all love me.
Yeah.
Lindsay Lohan wants to go out with me, but you know what? I'm a sober person, and Lindsay Lohan's just too crazy for me. And plus, I'm a man in love. Like Lindsay Lohan, I just would say no. Like, no, Lindsay, you got to roll out.
Oh, yeah. I definitely get that impression from you. I see all the time. I see every one of your pictures and every one of your girlfriend's pictures is a couple picture. And I think that's great because, the world needs
a
little more.
I know, we're a couple of assholes sometimes.
Yeah, you guys, the world needs a little more love, right?
She's wonderful. You know, I trust her with all my secrets. And, she also averts winter. So, I mean, how can you go wrong?
Yeah. Yeah, my girl's pretty crazy, too. She's pretty fun, you know. You got to hang on to the fun ones.
Yeah, I liked your wedding pictures. It was like I was almost there. I could taste the chicken.
Yeah, I didn't get to invite very many people I would have liked to invite it because we're not rich or nothing, but we tried.
We were there. We were disguised as the waiter and waitress. You didn't notice.
Yeah, like Fight Club pissing in my soup, right?
No, it was only good. We just put some pepper in. I was the pepper boy.
Pepper boy.
I wanted to.
I want to harass you. You got anything to read? Do you read some shit for us, or how you feel about this?
I got a lot of shit to read, and I have some good stuff to read as well. But I've got I'm going to start with a poem. I've got I got excerpts from a novel lined up, and I've got some flash fiction lined up. I probably don't have time to read them all, but
we'll
see what you think. I'll start with a poem from Antisocial Network, and I'm going to do County Fair.
All right.
County Fair. With chickens, humongous squash, pregnant pumpkins, award-winning pie-eating pigs, and real pigs eating garbage pies. Be careful of that shit in the barn where Blue Ribbon winners drink Pabst Blue Ribbon. The printed beer symbols on cracked plastic cups end up kicked around, beaten down loose dirt paths, clattering like bones from bustling city folks. At night, the merry-go-round and Ferris wheel move the line from point A, then back, and the ride stops in the middle. A boy sits between his parents, looks down, points from the peak of his world, hoping life stays that way just a few minutes more. So that's the county fair poem.
I like that a lot. I like any time people write about county fair stuff. So there's a great Bruce Springsteen song, County Fair, and
yeah,
my friend can't go wrong with county fair. So, what else you got?
I could read a flash piece. I'll read the flash fiction, and it's a piece I haven't read in a while. In fact, I haven't read it out loud in a while. I run a monthly series that I read every month, but so I might stumble a bit, but I'm ready for it. Cool. Flash piece is called The Beauty on the Inside. Violet was in her mother's apron pouch as her mother stood by the stove and stirred the sauce with a wooden spoon. "Hold this," Mother said. Violet felt the heavy weight of it, feared she would topple out of the slick plastic apron and onto the floor where she wouldn't be seen. Her mother lifted the top off the pot of broccoli. They looked like trees. She was too small to lift the plastic spoon up to crack her mother on the head with it. "I refuse to be in anyone's pocket," Violet said rebelliously years ago, before she fell out the first time and began life on her own. This was the time she had grown, joined a few armies, spoke to animals, and became educated. She didn't fall from the sky, but she flew and landed in a green forest. It was then she looked out and not up. There was no spoon to hold. Broccoli was just something to eat with a fork and not a big tree needing to be hacked down with a butcher knife. Violet soon managed short trips and then vacation. They felt like brief pieces of heaven. She saw the mountains, traveled to the cities, even drove a scooter in Rome. After that, Violet went to a small island and felt sand so warm, saw the grains as minute little rocks. She could lie there forever, taking time to greet the water. She was married to the ocean, but she couldn't swim, never learned how. The waves reached out, gave her love, and then shrank back, black and menacing, leaving her confused and wanting to drown. Violet called her mother, who told her she was naked on the sofa. Home seemed so casual. She imagined bending down to enter the house, and the doors became suddenly taller. She smelled the sauce on the stove. "Put on something, for Christ's sake," she yelled. Mother slipped on an apron that was hung from the mantel, scooped Violet up, and placed her inside. It wasn't until she was reunited with the spoon that she jumped, disappearing like a clove of garlic into the sauce. So that's the beauty on the inside.
That's really something else. What for people listening who are curious about Flash, what's your take on it, and what's your tip for people trying to make their writing a little better? What's the question?
My take on it is it's so versatile. Like, you can write, like that last piece, you can write something that's totally, completely in metaphor. You could write something that's just, like, totally out there and not. Or you can write, like, a miniature form short story that's, like, you know, real life hard hitting. And you could also write it like a traditional narrative poem, which is where the form started as. So it's like, you know, you can really, really do anything. You can make it, like, plot heavy, you can make it plot light. Like, there's so much you can do with it. And people are always like, you know, what can you do with 250 words? What can you do with 500 words? It's almost as if you can
do
more things.
Yeah, you really can.
Mm-hmm. And, like if you like a traditional short story, 3,000 to 5,000 words or 10,000 words or a novel, you don't have that wriggle room because whatever you're sort of trying to do becomes like, just dominates it. So any, like, little trick you might be doing can just, like, become too heavy in longer form.
Something happens with a short story that gets over 1,500 words. You really run the chance of just boring the fuck out of your reader.
But you also have to be able to be very, very accomplished to do that.
Yeah,
because, I mean, when I was reading Flush, and editing or whatever submissions, and the work gets like 2,000, 3,000. The piece could be going along great, and they just can't know. They just seem to not know what to do after 1,000, after 1,500, or they don't stick to the ending, or they don't stick the beginning. That's that. Like, I think Flash, like, if you kind of blow it, you know, and make a mistake, well, you know what? You can go back and write another one. And that's kind of how I feel about it. And it's like, it's a short form that I definitely got addicted to. And even my novel itself, it's sort of like a series of combined flashes. And the formatting of it is, you know, the novel's called The Thursday Appointments of Bill Sloan, and the chapters run like his descriptions. He's a psychologist. The chapters run his descriptions of his patients, and then the patient each has a flash, and it's the same as patient. And it goes, and it's, you know, it's... it's interesting to write that way, quite honestly.
Do you have an example of this book for everybody here?
I'll read the first chapter, or the first part of the chapter, which actually started as it's a flash piece, and the flash piece was published in the Legendary, and this is sort of this 500 word piece became a 90,000 word novel, which
there you go.
Kind of blows my mind because I'm sort of scared to start another novel in a lot of ways, and I'm kind of waiting for one to get picked up.
I hear you.
So this is chapter one of the Thursday appointments of Bill Sloan. Alarm clock, 7:22 a.m. Hit the snooze button three times. Wake up. Hannah, 28, 8:45 a.m. No call, no show. I could have slept an extra hour. Note to self, call Hannah after 10 o'clock. Might not be a morning person. Kate, 40, 9:45 a.m. I don't know why Kate sees me. She says she solves her own problems sitting in the woods. Kate tells me she's a sexual animal and wants to make love every day under a canopy of trees. She thinks she's a tribeswoman and would like to mate with all the tribe's men. Sex makes her angry when she's finished. She twirls her thick golden hair when she tells me she thinks that we should go into the woods together. I suggest she see a female therapist, and her response is, I've had a few intimate relationships with women. Kate says she was out there the other day and spoke to a squirrel. What did it say? All it said was, hi. She told the squirrel she loved it and placed it on her lap. Why can't people be like that, squirrel, is what I asked her. Seems like she related to the squirrel better than she did to people. She dreamed she and the squirrel were lovers. Then the hour ran out. Thomas, 47, 10:45 a.m. I'd like to kill Thomas. Thomas can't commit to anything. He's lonely, yet he pushes people away. He's funny, yet he has a mean streak. He gasps for love the way he gasps for air. He has asthma. Thomas only wants women he can't have. Thomas should live in a protected box. He feels if he makes love to a woman at least every 3 months, he'll be fine. Thomas doesn't realize that a woman might develop emotional attachments. During sessions, Thomas says, fuck it or fuck me a lot. I can see why Thomas has scars over his eyes. He's been in a few battles. Sometimes he confronts me about his lack of progress in therapy. Thomas doesn't realize healing should all come from within. Thomas doesn't realize within him is a soulless black hole. He always uses phrases like, when I finally hunker down. Thomas is rugged, but he's a big baby. I'd like to kill Thomas. Lunch, 11:30, cold sandwich, pulpy apple, juice box. Bradley, 58, 12:15 p.m. Bradley grew up in New York by Coney Island. It's rough being African-American in that particular section of New York, but that's just one of his excuses. He's had excuses since childhood. I feel he tossed his life into the gutter in his 20s because it was easier than focusing on a job or an education. Bradley wanted to be a helicopter pilot, an unrealistic expectation from someone who was only selling pants at Tello's and spending his paycheck on booze and drugs. Now he needs pillows as his elbows on his clothes have worn to near holes, which I can see at the window to his darkness, the shadows underneath. One time, he had made it an entire year without the stuff, but he never made his goal of flying choppers, so he relapsed. Bradley tells me his parents hated him all the way to their death. That's what you get when you burn your bridges, steal and fuck with a person's trust. You end up at a homeless shelter in your early 30s and here with a therapist in your late ones. It might be damn late for Bradley. New patient, Pearl, 48, 3 p.m. Pearl is not her real name. Her real name is Stella. Pearl used a fake name to get past the intake screener. I recognize her, but even if I didn't, she is striking dark hair and looking sensible against the world's whiteness. Pearl is my ex-wife. She is taking this hour to speak to me since I've not returned her calls in months. She needs a favor. This summer, can I take the kids and the dog for a few months? She's bought our kids a dog. The dog is driving her crazy. I can take the kids, but not the dog. She stomps her foot. The kids tell me the dog ate the television remote. The dog needs its own therapist. It's crazy. The kids are 19 and 22 years old, and they should be able to be by themselves and take care of the dog. if you had only them and they'd no responsibility, dog, and blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking what it would be like to be in a good relationship. It would be sweet, like a Pacific island. Pearl just came back from her honeymoon. I tell her to call me soon. Ethan, 9:04 p.m. Ethan is the youngest patient I've ever had. He is bipolar, and everything about him is jagged except for his hair, which is thick and straight. He has been brought to me because he told his teacher he thinks about suicide, and his parents want more than what he's getting in therapy at school. Ethan is very specific about his fantasies about flying and jumping off of bridges. I sense I'm helpless to prevent this. There are bridges in Boston, and his private school is very close to them. His parents come during the last 15 minutes each week. His mother is also bipolar. Usually one of them cries. Ethan reminds me of my own brother. When my brother was a teenager, he took a handful of my mother's Valium and washed it down with some old Crow from the liquor cabinet. When the ambulance came, the red lights rotated through our living room. I remember because I counted seconds by them. With Ethan, I just wanted to grab him and either hug or shake him, tell him not to do it, please don't do it, and sometimes after, I cry too. 5:15 p.m., extra hour of traffic, listen to Jay-Z, Home 645. And that was chapter one.
That's pretty crazy, man. I wish you all the luck in the world with that. I hope somebody picks it up, because can't wait to read that in print, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I've got some bites. I've gotten a lot of rejections.
Yeah.
I found that, like, it's more difficult in the small press than to get published than ever before. Like, I don't know, that's just sort of my experience. I don't know if anyone else has had that experience, but I think the wave of more people self-publishing, which is great, don't get me wrong, but that wave actually made it a lot more difficult to not self-publish.
Yeah. You think now it's like, I'm curious, do you have any theories on why that is? It seems like it would be the opposite, you know?
Well, I'm thinking that, if I have any theories, I've thought about it. I mean, it's my theory. It may or may not be correct, and it probably isn't correct at all. But I just kind of think that small presses are just streamlining, and they're putting out, I mean, it's always been difficult. They're putting out two or three, but I think it's much easier for them to say to an author who shows a little bit of promise just to be like, well, why don't they put it out themselves? So why don't you put it out yourself? And in the past, if there's a good idea or something that's got potential, I think that there's a more of a willingness to take maybe the time and the extra months to really go through the manuscript. There's a lot more, the small presses have a lot more perfect drafts, or perfect first drafts, or perfect final drafts, because, you know, it's less work for them, and, you know, the rest of them, there is a place for the rest of people to put it out and to get an edited manuscript out there as a self-published work. I mean, I decided early on I really never wanted to go that route, except maybe with, like an anthology of Flash or poetry that's already been published in other places, so that way, you know, I wouldn't have to work the editing process, and I've already known other eyes on it.
Yeah. Well, that's a lot of heavy stuff. I know you would think, when I think small press, and I agree with you, when I would think small press, that people have the time and energy to edit things, but really, you know, maybe they don't, you know. This guy's working jobs, it's not their full time gig and it's just their side thing. So they're really looking for tighter manuscripts, which seems like the opposite, you know.
And it depends on the press too. Like
yeah.
I mean, the more established ones, it's timing is amazing, because you almost have to catch a small press in the very early part of their existence. Because the more established ones, they could be queued up until 2015 and 2016. And that's fine. I'm fine with something being published in 2017. But for a lot of people, will see that and they won't submit to those presses. So they have to go and look at, like, presses that are just starting out, and it can hit or miss. I mean, I ran a press, and, like, you know, put out the Heat City Literary Review, and it's like, you know, it's a labor of love, and it's certainly not a labor of money, because what it is,
yeah.
is the money stock, you know.
Oh,
you're
yeah.
going to lose money, especially off the bat. So new small presses that might have openings for your work fairly soon, you know, they're going to be teetering on, like, you know, do they have $5,000 to $10,000 to lose to put out a small run, or even more if they want to go, you know, if they have a lot of grandiose ideas in terms of getting books in every bookstore and having to eat the returns, as they say, because that's super expensive. You know, that's,
yeah.
I mean, that will scale. Like, everything that doesn't sell, you get, like, the bookstores will say, do you want us to destroy them, or do you want us to send them back to you with, like, a tear sheet on it, you know, tear of the cover. Either way, you put out that book as the publisher, and it's gone. It's lost money.
Yep. That's the deal. Oh, shit. Well,
so when I'm not talking about depressing stuff, I'm talking about the depressing state of the publishing industry. But you know what? I just do it. I mean, I love writing. And you know,
oh, yeah.
part of it, if you put all those pieces together and, you know, publishers may or may not have the money for it, what ends up happening is the writer doesn't make money. And, like,
yeah.
the writer very often needs to settle for, like, doing the work for free. And I'm not necessarily willing to settle for that. Like,
yeah.
I mean, I can do a lot of things for free. I could write a story and, you know, go to a fax machine and pass it out on the T in Boston and, like, look, you know, 2,000 people saw my work today. But I'm not really necessarily worried. Like, yeah, I want to have at least the potential of making a few bucks. Now, I don't have the idea that I'm going to live on this, but just the potential that, you know, you never know.
Well, you never know until you try, too. Because that's the other thing with you know, you write a book and, you know, you can, if you don't submit it, if you don't at least take, you know, whatever, if you don't at least submit it, you never know. You know, you really never know. And I wonder how many books aren't getting the spotlight they deserve because people don't even take the time to submit them. They're just like, ah, fuck it, you know, I'm going to put this out myself, and then 80 people buy it and that's it, you know. So, but, you know,
I'm
self-publishing. Grandma and Aunt Joan buy it.
Yeah, it's interesting, Bud, because that was sort of like how I got started. I had like 11 short stories to my name, and I was going out on like paternity leave, and I sort of looked up a few presses. I was like, I'll send out a submission, and, like, you know, I'm just, because otherwise this stuff's just going to stick on my hard drive. And, you know, back in the day, the only computer I had that had email was my work computer. I didn't even have the internet at home. And, you know, I did the submission. I went on a paternity leave. My daughter was born. And I came back from there, and I opened my work email, and it was like, your work's been accepted. You know, we're ready to publish you. And it was like, you know, during the first wave of e-books, and, you know, the damn middle came out. Which
was
exciting.
Pretty awesome, man. Yeah, it is exciting. It's so great. It's just... There's this excitement for people who don't write, and, you know, I guess you could attribute it to, like, if any other creative thing, you know, you finish a painting, you write a song, whatever it is, you know, that thrill of writing it and then performing it, you know, going out and reading, and then there's this extra special thrill of writing a book, and you get to have a party. You get to have a party. That's pretty awesome, too.
Exactly, but, like, I guess I heard from your interview that you did a lot of musician work and you played in bands. Like, going out on readings, I mean, I did that when I was very young, and, you know, I played in a lot of places. So kind of going on readings, it's like something that's very kind of familiar to me. It's like, you know, you show up, you get a little time to do your reading, go back to your hotel, or, you know, in the old days, it was like you go to the bar, or, you know, now it's kind of like you go out to dinner. And, like, it's very familiar. Like, it's, you know, the whole travel aspect of it. And it's something that I really enjoy to do, but it's like, I can't imagine, like, what it's like for somebody that's really not doing it or has not really done that or had that experience before and stepping into, like, a venue for the first time and, like, reading their work. Because, like, I've been out so many times as a musician that the first time I read in front of people, like, I really didn't have, like, a really... objective view of it.
That's right. Yeah. Well, listen, Tim, man, it's been
it's been a real fucking pleasure talking to you tonight, and I'm really glad that you got to read such a variety of your work, from Poem, County Fair, that really badass piece of Flash, and then especially thanks for coming on and reading the first chapter in your novel. And like I said, man, I'm looking forward to reading that one in its entirety when it's all said and done and popping up somewhere for sale. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and well, I really appreciate you having me on the show, and it was great. And Tisha's listening downstairs, so I'll be downstairs in a minute, honey.
All right, say hi to her for me, okay? And take it easy, okay, man?
Yeah, you published her, by the way. But yeah, you published her at one of your anthologies coming out, so that's pretty awesome. And it's great talking to you and meeting you. And have a great rest of the show.
Yeah, man, I'll catch you up in Boston one of these days, okay?
Always welcome. It'll be great to meet you.
All right,
take care.
Okay, so that will be the show for tonight. It's a lot of fun talking to all these people. Pat Noon, 816 Recording Studios, Babel, New Jersey. If you're a band in the New Jersey area, even if you're in the Philly area, New York City area, I recommend checking Pat out, 816 Studios. And you can reach him through his website. Just look up 816 Recording Studios. And I want to thank Marion Winnick for coming on and talking about her great book, Glen Rock Book of the Dead. And we're talking about some of her other projects going on. And of course, I want to thank again Tim Gager. Tim Gager. Thanks for coming on, Tim. And thanks, everybody, for listening. Hope you all have a nice night. I'm going to go cook some dinner.